and welcome to Introducing Me. I'm your host, Sarah. I started this podcast to get to know other people and lifestyles while discovering more about myself. Each episode, I will give a new guest a chance to discuss their background, culture, interests, or whatever they want to talk about to help increase all of our own worldviews. Today, I would like to introduce you to Liz. She is a music educator. She does a lot of different research about music culturally and, you know, has a good background in teaching. And so she'll talk a little bit about that, a little bit about herself. And so I'm excited to hear what she has to say today and hear a little bit about her. So Liz, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you say hello? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me. As Sarah said, my name is Liz. I live in the Washington metropolitan area. I grew up in Prince George's County. And I enjoy music, learning about people, culture, and that's informed a lot of my research interests.
Awesome. So how did you end up getting into music that it ended up becoming a full-time profession?
That's interesting. I grew up in a very large church, Metropolitan Baptist Church in the heart of Washington, D.C. And my family also went to the church. My mom is like second generation. My grandmother is first generation in the church. So I'm third generation. And we took part in a lot of different ministries. And one of the ministries I took part in as a child was the youth ministry, children's church, and the youth choir. So before I was an instrumentalist, I was singing in the youth choir. And I kind of fell in love with music and, you know, just wanted to be more involved. So I learned how to play trumpet and euphonium. I was in band throughout elementary, middle school, and high school. And between being in band and in school and singing in the choir at church, I just kind of fell deeper in love with music and wanted to know a little bit more about how music works. I would always be enamored by how the conductor in band would have his score and, you know, just kind of know that where everything was supposed to happen. And I was even more inspired by the musicians at church who never seemed to conduct from a score. It was all the music was just kind of there, and they were able to make split decision choices in the moment, in the middle of worship. They really all had an impact on me and just how I thought about music, how I thought about my own performance and my own connection and the things I wanted to know about music. So I went to Susquehanna, studied music, got more of the technical aspects of it, and then that curiosity just kind of kept going.
And what did you do after college?
So after college, I majored in music technology at Susquehanna. And then I decided I wanted to teach music. So in between going to grad school to get my music teaching certification, I worked in a bridal shop for a little while. So I got knee deep into the culture of weddings, you know, color swatches, dress patterns and all those different types of things. So that was like the one quirky turn in my life. And then I went to, you know, Towson for my master's in music education. And during that time, I also took undergrad classes for, instrumental methods, secondary methods, so I can make sure that I was getting the practical part of teaching music while also getting the theoretical parts of teaching and learning at the graduate level. So during the early 2000s, I was going to school basically for, you know, from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. at night and working in the middle and also maintaining my job at the bridal shop. So it was a good time to be, you know, 22, 23, 24, 25.
Yeah, it sounds like you were quite busy. So at any point when you were in undergrad doing music technology, were you ever thinking, oh, I should be getting a music education degree? I might want to teach. Or did that really happen after graduation?
I started out as music ed, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do at that point. And I will say this, that I wasn't having as much success academically in the music department as I wanted to, or that I thought that I could have. And I didn't want to change my major altogether. So I looked at the course offerings and I said, okay, well, I can change to music technology and still get the education that I want, but not be so beholden to the department. As you know, or it may have changed, like music ed majors tend to have a very packed schedule. And so their schedules at that time kind of seemed to be, you know, thought out for them. Switching to music technology let me have a more flexible course schedule. And that's actually how I got into one of the forms of research that I look at. I took a class called Sociology of Organizations. I don't know if Dr. Ramsaran is still at Susquehanna, but I took it with him. And that was getting into the sociological nature of working with groups. And in that class, I treated the performance ensemble as an organization and was able to apply sociological theory to the organization, to the ensemble, to even the music department. And that sparked my research. And that was in 2004. I maintained that interest through the first graduate degree. And then lo and behold, I was able to place that interest into my dissertation when I graduated from University of Southern California in 2017. So organizational theory became my entry point into examining how social capital and cultural capital is formed within performance ensembles. And I would have never had that opportunity if I did not change my major from music education to music technology. So when I realized that that was what was happening a few years ago, I was like, oh, wow, this really came full circle.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I know I did not do music education at Susquehanna, but at least 5 years ago, it was still very planned out for them, was very busy. And Dr. Amsterdam is still at Susquehanna. I believe he's still doing some teaching, but I believe his current title is provost.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So he's doing really well at Susquehanna. I have no idea what that entails. but he's in the big leagues. So I think it's great how you had those opportunities to take that class with him, to get a little bit outside of the education world and then be able to come back into it. So can you talk a little bit about this research and what you have learned and what you're still studying?
For sure. So social capital is one of the main three forms of capital that came about from Pierre Bourdieu in the 1970s. So we look at capital as an accumulation of resources. So we have economic capital, which is the most common, that's money. We have cultural capital, which is the accumulation of knowledge or social status. And then social capital, which is the accumulation of some of those intangible things like trust, obligation, those things that make relationships work. So I decided to study essentially what makes a band a family and getting into that those social capital markers within a performance ensemble. So I was able to do that research when I was just, you know, about maybe 5 years ago at this point. And I was able to kind of see the links between performance ensembles, how we engender trust, obligation, support, and how those things are connected to cultural capital and also economic capital, all within running a secondary performance ensemble. And that led me to different disparities that may be present within performance ensembles and looking at ways that disparities can be alleviated. When I started teaching back in 2007, one of our instrumental music supervisors said that, you know, teaching a child an instrument can be the way or the access point for them to go to college. And while I believe that that is true, that it opens up an opportunity, but if there are certain markers of cultural capital or social capital and economic capital that that student or that family doesn't possess, even if they go into college with this, with with being able to get into college, with learning how to play an instrument, getting scholarships for playing an instrument in ensemble, there may be things within that institution that may prevent the student from being successful, even though they have accumulated a substantial amount of wealth. The wealth that's possessed in that institution may be vastly different, and that student may still find themselves at a disadvantage. So the next leg of my research looks at social justice in music education. What are those barriers to access and opportunity that exist inherently in our K-12 curriculum? And then how do we as teachers perpetuate that? Is it at the in-service level, the pre-service level, the collegiate teaching level? Like, what are those things that that thwart access for an equitable education at all levels?
That sounds really fascinating, and I'm definitely interested to see what comes up of it. And as even in just that last question of where does it go, where do we fix the problem? So what are you seeing in your classroom? Are you able to talk about that and kind of how your work is coinciding in what you're actually teaching?
Yeah. So I'm very mindful of the relationships that I form with my students and the relationships that they form with each other. That intentionality of connecting with people and also letting them know that that I'm here to support them in any ways possible. Within middle school, the kids are really developing the first those parts of their identity where they're, you know, striking out on their own, separate from their parents, separate from their friends. And I look at the orchestra and the band as an opportunity to help them, you know, refine those social skills as needed, being able to support other students and making good decisions for themselves. In terms of access, I try to make sure that my students have as many opportunities as possible to participate, to have outside resources. So sometimes that means that I'm doing a lot of fundraising, or I'm, you know, relying on the kindness of my colleagues and me also giving back to their programs as well. And in that, we've kind of created a community of practice where, you know, I'm able to support another colleague and support their students, and they're able to come and support mine.
So that's really great how mindful you're being of your students, their interactions. And when I think about back to my middle school and high school band experiences, it is very much that family culture. So it's great to hear all of the support you're giving them. Did you have similar support from your teachers throughout your music performing in education?
Yeah, definitely. And more so in high school than in middle school. Middle school was just kind of a blur. You know, you're there for 2 years. But when in high school, there was this culture of family, this thing that was already present. So it was easy to kind of, you know, get involved with that, you know, through marching band. I didn't make it through marching band camp, so I just stayed to the to concert and symphonic band. But even being able to be a part of those experiences tangentially and being welcomed into the spaces was, you know, very important to me. It's interesting how much the band had an impact on the school, even, because there are people who I knew their names in high school, but wasn't, you know, necessarily like their friend or anything like that. We didn't even have class together. I just knew who they were. And, you know, as an adult, you'll run into them and then come to find out they knew who I was too, because I was in the band, which is different, because in pop culture, there's a lot of talk about the band geeks and that sort of thing. But I'm proud to say that everybody in the band and choir and orchestra, we were all pretty cool. You know, at least that's what I recognize now, because strangers know who we are, you know, that sort of thing. But even still, the band in my high school band is very supportive. My high school director was very supportive. He even came to one of the concerts in Susquehanna. Him and his wife drove 3 hours and came to my first college concert, which is pretty cool. And I've made some good connections with folks who are, you know, 10 or 15 years younger than I am. In 2008, our director was selected to go take a trip to Beijing, performance tour, a pre-Olympic festival, if you will. And he invited alumni. I was a part of that group, as well as current students and folks from his church. So I got to meet all the kids when they were in high school. I met one of my former euphonium students when he was a junior, and now he's, you know, teaching in PG County, just like I am. So we kind of keep that thing going, you know. We are supportive of each other, and even though life kind of pulls you apart, you know, you can still have that shared experience and know that there's at least someone out there that can support you, or that you can lend help to someone if they're in need.
And what are your hopes for your program in the future?
I would very much like to have a program that is free to explore music in a way that's organic and authentic to the students. I think that sometimes the curriculum can be a little bit prescriptive. You know, stateless, perform this music, learn these particular set of skills and that sort of thing. And although there is a place for that type of prescriptive curricula, I think allowing students to tap into their natural musical abilities and allowing them to develop their own interests within the classroom as a community is even more valuable. So I would love to be able to have a program that prioritizes musical freedom rather than some of those experiences that we tend to have over and over and over again. I tell my colleagues, I said, you know, I grew up in PG County and now I teach for PG County in secondary school. I said, you know, the educational experience or performance experience is the same. In middle school, we learned some skills, learned a piece, went to festival, got adjudicated, did the same thing at 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade. And then you go and teach, and then that's the schedule. You learn some stuff, you take your kids to the festival, you get adjudicated, and then you do the same thing next year. And each year you're trying to, you know, get better, build upon your program. But there are so many things that get left behind. You know, I would really just want to be able to allow the students to experience music and be able to open myself up to new musical experiences through the lens of my students. So that's a very lofty goal, but I think that's a place where music education needs to go.
Yeah, and you know, to do the same things over and over and have required lists. Now, are you able to bring in different music and share like diverse composers and different kinds of music with your students?
Oh yeah, definitely. I do that through the means of listening. Either, you know, just like some listening assignments. If I heard something that's cool, we'll take a break from, you know, performing exercises out of the book and we'll just listen to something and talk about it. If I can find the score, even better, I'll display it. And then that way the students can kind of see how sound is translated onto the page. And it kind of, in middle school, it kind of opens up their eyes and say, oh my God, how can somebody play that high? There's a lot of ink on that page. Those notes are really fast. And, you know, it's like, yeah, you can do it. You know, we're just going to keep learning and you'll be able to get to those things that are those 16th notes that are a little bit faster than the eighth note and the chord note and so on and so forth. But it helps kind of place a level of curiosity and wonder through those types of listening exercises. And I try to bring in contemporary composers of color, Composers like Omar Thomas and Juan Pablo Contreras are two composers that are, you know, around the early 30s, who are not who create music that is very energetic and is has a very strong cultural connection to their to their upbringing. And I show my students all that their type of music specifically, because in orchestra or band, sometimes that early music doesn't really connect to your experience. It doesn't really connect to what you may hear at home or what you may select to listen to. And so one day I played Omar Thomas's Come Sunday, and it was a kind of like an analog of what it's like to be in a Black Baptist church for testimony and during a praise and worship service with shouting. So those the kids connected to it. You know, the first time I heard it, I connected to it. So I was like, yeah, my kids are really going to like this. And even with Juan Pablo Contreras, he does work that is bringing mariachi music into the orchestra. And as we, you know, I have a large population of students who are Latinx or Hispanic, and their eyes kind of lit up when they heard the orchestra performing music that they connected to. So I try to do that as much as possible through listening. If it's accessible for the age group, if we can play something like that, I try to do that as well. But as it turns out, there's not a lot of grade one or grade two music that kind of fits that mold. So we just keep kind of listening, and they can always share experiences with me. One of the things that I watch Steven Universe. It's a cartoon on Cartoon Network, and a lot of my kids watch Steven Universe as well. And it has a really cool soundtrack that's mostly a 16-bit video game music. So we'll play the music in class, and I'll sketch out a melody for them, and then that kind of makes them feel good about life, like you know, Dr. Palmer is connecting to me, and, you know, we're connecting with each other, and we're doing something that gives us a little bit of choice.
I love that you're literally like watching the cartoons they're watching, kind of meeting them on that level. And, you know, when I asked the question, I didn't even, because it's been a long time since I played middle school music, I didn't even think about the fact that most music is written for higher levels. And of course, you need that grade one, grade two music that they're able to play. So I love hearing that you're at least able to give them those connections through listening. Is there a market, or are there people out there writing new music for grades one and two, or are you kind of stuck with a lot of what you were playing at that age?
there's a market for it. I think I want to say that the composition market is kind of driven by curricula and vice versa. So some of the music that may come about, whether it's self-published or published from a publishing house, it probably will not be that same, that music that connects to culture, because I found that culture kind of connects, cultural music has much more difficult rhythm. So it probably won't get to that one grade one or two level unless there is some sort of electronic background for it. So, you know, band or orchestra with electronic tape, where the complexity of music from, you know, Latin America or hip hop and other African drumming and music is connected to a source that's not actually performed by the students. So the students will be playing melody or rhythms that are less complex, but above the actual grounding. And I would like to see more music come about that gives that kind of anchor in the music. 'Cause I've realized that even in side-by-side concerts where you have an older musician playing with a younger musician, the younger musician's confidence is boosted by playing next to somebody who's older, because they, you know, they now feel like they can do it too. And so I would venture to say that if there is music that's grade one or grade two that has connections to those complex rhythms of different diverse musics, then that will also kind of increase their confidence and their ability to perform and really connect with the music.
Yeah, and I think you're definitely right on the whole confidence level. I know when I had opportunities to play with older students, it was extremely exciting because you look up to those older students and know, like, hey, they're doing really cool things. But as you said, it goes back to what they're taught. You know, if you're being taught how to write more complex, more modern music, you're not necessarily going to say, like, hey, I'm going to write grade one, grade two, and simplify it.
Right. And there's a place for educational composition, as it's called. But we tend to see the same folks doing that over and over again. Folks who take pop songs and they write them for educational ensembles. And that type of thing is very common, but it also has to, you kind of have to break away into a new method of connecting music to younger generations, where they have so much more access to music that is complex. You know, when my mom and dad were growing up in the 50s and 60s, the music was complex, but it wasn't as rhythmic as the music is today. And kids, you know, in my classroom are drawn to the complex rhythms, and they tap out the complex rhythms on tables and things of that nature. And they want to be able to play those complex rhythms, but we need to have a bridge to help them get there.
So taking a slight turn, you know, I found out about you because you were recently elected to, I'm going to butcher the exact title, but the board for our professional music fraternity, Sigma Alpha Iota, in a new position that has to deal with diversity and inclusion. And even just hearing everything you've talked about so far and all of your research, I'm like, yep, Liz was a great person for this role. So would you be willing
to,
you're welcome. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about maybe your experience in SAI, getting this position, and some of the things that will happen in the future?
Yes, of course. So I joined SAI in fall 2002, Sigma Omega Chapter at Susquehanna University. And I was a junior in college at the time. And shortly after that, I was elected president of the chapter. And that was it was a great opportunity. And I really enjoyed my time serving as president. I got to get to know the sisters in the chapter on a much more intimate level than simply just being a classmate or being someone that we're in, you know, the university band with or something to that nature. And then, you know, I graduated shortly after becoming president. So I was, you know, president my senior year. And then, you know, I went to grad school. In Towson at the time did not have a SAI chapter. And I didn't really know much about the Baltimore or the Washington, D.C. alumni chapters. So I joined back with SAI shortly after moving back to Maryland from my doctoral studies. And prior to that, I, you know, applied for the doctoral grant and received the doctoral grant for to continue my dissertation research. Then I, you know, moved back to Maryland and I joined the Washington, D.C. alumni chapter. So that allowed me to, you know, keep a connection to SAI, its purposes, and to meet more SAIs who lived in Washington, D.C. area. I'm still active in that chapter, and I've been active in the chapter for about the last 3 or 4 years. And as you know, when the National Board opened up the application process for the Director of Diversity and Inclusion, I thought it was something that I could do to serve the organization itself. Drawing on my experiences at Susquehanna, my experiences at Towson, USC, the experience of being in an alumni chapter, and kind of seeing where a diversity and inclusion officer could really make an impact on the lives and well-being of SAIs across the country. I said, this is something that I want to do. I want to give back, and I want to be able to give voice to those who may not feel like they have a voice, or maybe even start some initiatives that can really help bring diversity and inclusion to the forefront and really round out the mission and the vision of our organization.
Awesome. And do you, or are you able to speak a little bit about some of those actions that you'll be able to take?
Not at the moment, but I do have a lot of ideas. And I think that those ideas would be a good foundation for growth going forward. The way that I'm approaching this new role is going from here to the July 2022 convention. So what are some things that we can start doing that will show some incremental growth and progress? What are some things that we can do within the next 3 to 6 months that can have a lasting impact? And then lastly, as we get to the convention, what is something that can have an impact, an annual impact going forward? So something that I would like to see happen is being able to have some sort of a social justice or diversity and inclusion impact grant that can support chapters who are doing social justice work, whether it be in their communities, in the local school system, or something of that nature, things that are action oriented. That's an idea that I have, but I believe that it's something that can happen. I just don't know how to make it happen yet. So I'm going to say it and will it into existence. And I hope that it's something that can happen. Even if it doesn't happen now, that it's can be something that's on the, you know, and that can happen in the future. I think one of the best strengths of SAI is that we are community oriented. You know, we have Philanthropies Inc. That goes out into the world and does these great and amazing things. Individual chapters who are having an impact in their community. And I would like to continue that through the lens of social justice, diversity, and inclusion.
Awesome. And I'm really excited to see where you're able to take this position and what you're able to do. Of course, a new position at a director level in a national fraternity is going to be probably very overwhelming with so many unknowns. So I'm excited to hear some of your plans, and I'm excited to go to convention next year and see where we've gotten even in just a year. I think there's a lot that can be done. And of course, being on the national board, you'll be able to see beyond just the few chapters that you've already interacted with your personal experiences to see what are other people doing.
Yeah, for sure. I think the one of the coolest things about, you know, Greek life is that each chapter, although it is an extension of the national organization, you know, each chapter is informed by its local roots, its community, the school that it's attached to. And I would just love to find out ways that those connections can be celebrated, you know, whether it's at historically Black colleges and universities or institutions that are serving the Latinx community. Like, how is culture informing SAI at those places? You know, even a school like Susquehanna that is, you know, in the central Pennsylvania Dutch, you know, there are going to be some traditions that may not occur in New York City or occur in DC or even the Southwest. So it'll be good to bring those identities to the forefront and kind of celebrate the vast diversity that the SAI chapters have within themselves.
Definitely. Yeah. I feel like I've only just gotten into in the past like year or two learning about music that is not traditionally taught or whatever it may be. And if, you know, there are opportunities, and if it can even happen at the organizational level with SAI, I think that's a great opportunity. Because, you know, we are music focused, we are a professional organization. You know, at Susquehanna, we are like next to the Greek organizations, but because we're not social, it's a little bit separate. Right. So it's interesting, and even just attending province days and hearing from different chapters. So it'll be exciting to see what happens.
Yeah, so much of this position is going to be about casting a net and see what comes back. Because it is I am originating the role setting an agenda. You know, you just gotta see what happens. And I hope that whatever happens is effective and impactful, and at the very least, it helps people in our organization feel seen and heard and cared for.
So one of the other things that you are doing and you are in charge of is a nonprofit that helps with various things in music for students, educators. So I think that that's super exciting with all of the other things that you're doing. So would you be able to talk a little bit about that nonprofit?
Sure. Modern Maestro, Inc. is a nonprofit that is dedicated to supporting professional development, enrichment opportunities for students, as well as providing some fiscal sponsorship for booster programs in secondary schools. So within the nonprofit, you know, I started out wanting to just be a resource and support teachers, support students in the local community. So we've been around for about 4 or 5 years. And every so often, we'll put out an opportunity for professional development. Before the pandemic, I was able to host a good friend of mine, Andrew Harrison, who is a professor of saxophone at St. Antonio College in California. And he did a very great professional development with two local high schools, saxophone ensembles. They performed with him, and then he actually gave a little bit of information about best practices for playing saxophone. So talking a little bit about articulation, reed selection, and things of that nature. And it went over very well with the guests who were there. You know, the teachers that came were able to get a professional development certificate to go towards their annual professional development requirements as needed. And yeah, I think it had a really great impact on the community. So I look forward to doing those types of those programs and events, as well as helping ensembles and programs get the materials and the resources that they need to be successful.
Great. And is this something that's more specifically local to your area, or are you able to welcome people outside of the Baltimore, D.C. area?
You know, I keep it local to my area just because it's a very small operation. But if there are other people who need support and reach out, I'll do what I can to support them and look into ways that they can be supported from a distance if that's what's required.
Great. And I always, you know, with organizations like that, there's always good resources to even then take back to your own networks, and I'm sure sharing different things on what you can and can't do. And I think it's great that you are clearly really supporting your area and your students and your fellow peers. And I love all of that you've been able to share.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I also got a donation of 5 instruments, so 3 violins and 2 trumpets that, you know, looking to get refurbished and give those out to those to students who need them, or programs that need them to loan out to students in their community. So I accept donations of, you know, instruments and cash donations that could be put back into the community. And it comes with a nice little tax write-off for those who donate.
Now, I'm not sure I have other specific questions. I'm sure there's more that we could touch on. So what else would you like to share with the listeners?
A little bit of not quirky, but I am a sucker for those pet videos where the dogs and the cats get along very well. They're super cute. And it reminds me of my own pets that I had growing up. Nothing like the Tom and Jerry situation where the mouse and the cat didn't get along, or and the pit bull came in and was terrorizing the cat. But no, my dogs and cats always got along, and I love to see just how cute those videos are.
I love that that's what came to mind. Yeah. We can learn so much from animals, and they're so ridiculously cute.
They are. And especially those videos of the pets who were adopted and look so sad in the cages, and then they get love and support, and now they have a new lease on life. And I like that because I believe that with a little love and support, even, you know, obviously people can, you know, can be transformed and, you know, have a new outlook and restart their lives and from a different vantage point. So, you know, for me, loving people and giving them, you know, new opportunity is important. And I guess that's manifested through my love of pet videos.
Hey, it can manifest through pet videos, and I think comes out in, you know, your research, in your music, those family connections that we were talking about earlier. So I think it's great. So with all of my guests at the end, I ask a little bit of a random question that is different from what we've been talking about. One of the things that we have not covered, that we haven't had a chance to talk about, is travel. So my question for you is, where are you looking forward to traveling in the future? You know, you came back to where you grew up. You're teaching in your home district. So I'm curious to know, where will you go in the future?
You know, since we're in the middle of the pandemic, I realized that I never took as many vacations as I should have. And I've been dreaming about where I want to go for, you know, almost a year now, right? I would like to go to some sort of beach resort situation. Like, I just want to look at blue skies, blue water, good weather, and just soak up the vitamin D. I just want to relax. But if I had to put a location on that, I would probably say going to either Fiji or the Maldives would be ideal. Because I like looking at those little huts where you can, you know, you can see the ocean from the bottom of your hut and that sort of thing. So yeah, I'll say Fiji or the Maldives.
Yeah, I think especially after the last, you know, year or so, all of our teachers need a good vacation. And definitely it has given us that moment to realize that, hey, we should take more vacations.
Right. Right. Although now would be the time to travel because everything is so much cheaper, but it's also just not the safest time to travel. So it's like, you know, it's just gotta, you know, play your cards right.
All right, that brings this episode to a close. I will be leaving a link to the Facebook page of Modern Maestro, which is the nonprofit that Liz runs and mentioned a little bit earlier. So definitely go give that page a like and see what she's got going on there. I'm sure, you know, you'll find some great resources, and I'm excited to share that resource with my listeners. And of course, if you'd like to connect with the podcast, we are on social media, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, so go give those pages a like. We are on Patreon for monetary support. And of course, if you are a new listener and would like to be a guest on this show, I'm always looking for new people and love hearing new stories. So feel free to email me. The email is in the description as well. It is introducingmepodcast@gmail.com. So thank you, Liz, so much for spending time with me today. I had a great time hearing everything you had to share. And to my listeners, for taking the time out of your day to hear a new story. Until next time, bye.
Take care. Thank you so much for having me.